Chapter 2. The Rainbow Room. Our new house. Boxes everywhere. Naturally, I chose the biggest bedroom and started to make myself comfortable. But bare walls and wide unfurnished spaces are tough to call home. It was unfamiliar, just like my new classroom, which, though furnished, had a starkly modern touch. Perfectly arranged desks. Children assembling in front of a smart board. The entire school resembled a stock photo. Mrs. Gideon, our teacher, had little patience for my antics. The ring of her words resounded in my ears long after they left her mouth, giving way to bitter tears and a body set aflame.
"Don't do that," she bellowed. "I'm not playing games, Max. I will tell your parents about this."
If I attacked her, I'd be restrained in milliseconds. If I ran out of class, Mrs. Gideon's assistant, Mrs. Hickman, would drag me back. Personally, I can't recall a day we weren't at odds. Most of the lessons took place on a carpet in front of the smart board. I'd sit on that accursed spiky blue cushion. At first, they permitted me to sit near my peers. Within a week, they had squashed me into a corner with a tiny desk. I tried to take part in the lessons. If Mrs. Gideon was reading something to the class, I'd move my chair as close as they allowed. Head tilted, I'd listen. Beyond that, unless it was computing, I'd struggle to participate. When assigned a handwriting task, the classroom's paper supply vanished. For reasons I don't remember, Mrs. Gideon wouldn't allow me to use an eraser, so if I made a mistake, I'd need a fresh sheet. What was the point in participating? The teachers only seemed to provide fleeting acknowledgement and praise. Therefore, I sat isolated, reading whatever books I found. As I took part less and less in classroom activities, I began doing my own. I read books, made rudimentary arts and crafts, and taught myself how to use scissors. My peers found these things and others straightforward, so I thought learning to do them would bring me closer to acceptance in school. But I'd soon discover that, unlike my peers, I had to be inventive and find strategies when my body refused to cooperate. Often raw determination saw me through. Every achievement represented something I thought I'd never be able to do. My cheeks turned red with pride. I'd have to jump up and down, behaviour which Mrs. Gideon responded to with shouting and scornful glares. One day I took a pair of scissors and made a chick. As I recall, it was a sheet of paper cut into what I thought looked like a baby chicken. This is the sole creation I remember. Because it was the first time I had used a pair of scissors successfully. At break time I showed it to Bradley, only for another boy to knock me to the ground. I reached out to hit him, only to have my hand trampled on. Mouth dry, I squinted at my assailant, the same boy who had beaten me to the floor the previous year. Visions of that day still tormented me. I couldn't let him press the advantage, so I attempted to bite his leg. He yelped back, but my attack was a ploy, something to distract him as I staggered to my feet. We faced each other. Bradley's lip muscles moved, albeit no words escaped his mouth.
"Mrs. Gideon," I called.
No response, as she continued talking to Mrs. Hickman.
"Mrs. Gideon?"
"Nope. No help is coming." The boy smirked, snatching at my creation and tearing it to shreds. Inflamed tears welled up in my eyes. Bradley backed away. The enemy was bigger, but I had no choice. Run and he would catch me. Do nothing and he'd beat me senseless. Fight and I might win. Charging into the face of doom, I bit my tormentor's arm. A fist slammed into my chest. Breath trembling, I caught myself.
"Mrs. Gideon,"
my assailant called with a sickening grin. She sprinted over with Mrs. Hickman. They forced me to the floor, detaining me as I hollered. Nobody listened. Bradley did nothing. I was left alone in the classroom to cry whilst they soothed the boy I viewed as the undeniable aggressor. In another incident, I defecated in class. Out of shame, I hid the small pellet in my desk. The school cleaners found it. The school telephoned my parents. Mrs. Gideon took me before the class. She told my peers, smiling as she lectured on the importance of hygiene. Some giggled. Others stared blankly, their jaws hanging open.
"Dad, I want to be a normal boy,"
I said as we were driving home from school. No Cars Go by Arcade Fire playing in the background. Either Dad played that or A Jigsaw Falling Into Place by Radiohead.
"You're normal to us. We love you,"
Dad said to console me.
"Nobody else does."
"Nonsense. Grandma and Barbara love you."
Face squeezed against the window. Taking in the music, I wondered why it seemed that the rest of the world hated me. Sadly, things would continue to spiral downward. A new boy called Benjamin Goldstein joined our class. He got friendly with Bradley. I didn't mind this. People had often encouraged me to share, so perhaps this was my chance. I'd tried to join in and Benjamin would order Bradley away from me. No matter what, he dismissed all requests for us three to play together. My attempts to share had failed, and I could only seethe as Benjamin stole Bradley.
"Why can't you all play together?" adults suggested.
For the most part, I sought to follow through on this advice. It never worked. Benjamin just avoided me. I'd clench my jaw as they played together. An appalling sight.
"Get rid of Benjamin and get Bradley back,"
became the sole focus of my thoughts. I hurled insults, made virulent threats, hurt him. I would beam and Benjamin would break down. Bradley was no longer a focus. The thrilling ecstasy of power, its own reward. If I got in trouble, it didn't matter. It was all part of being the bad guy. All good villains need their minions. So I used two twins, telling them,
"It's fun, you won't get into trouble."
They didn't. And together we would bully Benjamin, destroying his possessions, taunting him when he cried. Every day, every lesson, every hour, there was no avoiding our wrath. His father threatened to sue my family, and the situation with me in class had reached a breaking point. Therefore, the school decided I should spend lunchtime in the rainbow room. My face dropped when there weren't any rainbows. The room was drab. Miniature, with a dirty carpet that may as well have been mouldy concrete. With no windows, it was effectively my prison at lunchtime. It was in a compound, you had to enter through two enormous doors in the cafeteria. If I had to guess, the rainbow room and other rooms in the school changed purposes often. There were toys and some computers. They allowed me to play with them if I didn't cause trouble. It meant they didn't have to worry about me outside of lessons. Soon, various incidents would change that. One involved a ball in the school tuck shop. It was close to the classroom. I'd brought a pound from home to spend. When I passed there during lunch break, my eyes fixated on a small football, the mini kind. I had the money. Mrs. Hickman told me I could buy it later, after school had ended. That lunchtime, the rainbow room shook with my jumping. After school, I made my way to the tuck shop. With a smile, I gave a pound to the clerk.
"You can't buy that, Max," called Mrs. Gideon.
How did she know?
"Why? Why not?"
She sighed, banging her hands together.
"Chop, chop! Home time!"
I fell back. She motioned to the clerk, who threw the ball. Before I could blink, Miss Gideon caught it.
"Miss Hickman said I could buy it!"
I cried, my eyes filling with tears as I attempted to reach for the ball. She forced me aside.
"Mrs. Hickman made a mistake. Come on, your mummy is waiting."
Every word was a sharper needle.
"Max, I don't have time for this nonsense. You will come outside with me."
She grabbed my skinny arm with such force that the bones seemed to wince under the pressure. Legs scraping, dragged outside, I was handed to Mum like yesterday's rubbish. Episode 2, The Fire Alarm. The twins I'd enlisted as minions identified a glossy red button. I pressed it. The school erupted in the shrill blaring of the fire alarm. It was an honest mistake. I didn't understand what it did. Two teachers grabbed me by the arms, dragging me upstairs, my knees bashing against every step, like a prisoner of war being taken before the warden. In my case, that was the head teacher, who defaulted to a vicious rant at the sight of me.
"He did what?"
asked Grandpa.
"I pushed a button, Baba,"
I said. The head teacher continued her tsunami of rage, arms flapping about at 1,000 miles a second. My grandfather winced, barely stifling a laugh. Back at my grandparents' flat, I sat with my head bowed in front of the television, my lower body covered in carpet burns and bruises. My nose was splotchy and withered, as if someone had crushed it with a brick. I received a letter from the head teacher, addressed to me, which Grandma read out. "Do you know how many children we have in school?" I'd say the fire alarm incident, coming on top of many others, ended my days in the classroom. School became the Rainbow Room. When I entered in the morning, two teachers escorted me there and back. The same went for home time. They sealed me in there for hours. Nobody came unless I cried until my throat pleaded for mercy. And the person who regularly came, she was my jailer, a teaching assistant, or TA for short. Playing the role of jailer, she never let me out of her sight. Every time I ran out into the complex, she would shout, wrestle me to the floor and pin me down with bulky objects. And all the while I wept and howled for dear life. Time on the computers was a rare luxury, and it introduced me to some older children. One boy showed me Miniclip, a site where you played games for free. He had other friends he could have been with. Instead, he and this girl hung out with a 5-year-old. Lunchtimes with them were the only ones I'd openly smile. I never understood why they showed me such kindness. The concept of older children caring for me like a friend was alien. When they left, the TA would take over. No learning, no fun. They paid her to leave me to rot in dirty nappies. On one occasion, when I bit her jumper in defiance, she tried to pin me to the floor with a giant stuffed platypus.
"He bit my jumper," she boomed, holding up a sleeve to show the bite marks. "I can't see them," Dad replied. "Look closer."
He raised an eyebrow.
"Can't see a thing. I'm sure your jumper will survive."
Much screeching followed from the TA. Dad wasn't allowed in the building after that. Those were my school days from then on at the Blue House Primary. Eventually, they withheld permission from the older children to enter the Rainbow Room. The bad guy always goes to jail. They left me to sob. My trousers were always soaking. There was nothing to do but reflect. How had I got here? After all, it was Benjamin who had stolen Bradley. How could they do this? Why would they do this? If they had just paid attention, I wouldn't have been there. A woman visited me. She bought toys, asked me questions, and ran through exercises.
"That's the TARDIS," I pointed out.
"Oh, what does that do?" the woman asked.
We can go anywhere."
She visited weekly until one day I ended up in a room with my parents. It looked like a hospital of some sort, complete with adults claiming to be doctors. They asked me many questions.
"Why do you hurt Benjamin? He's bigger than you." "He's bigger than me, but he's easy to hurt."
Besides the questions, they asked me to draw pictures. The ones I presented involved me harming children in a variety of ways. I even built a child-killing machine with the chairs in the reception room. I had reinvented the guillotine. The child's head would catch between the chairs and fall off. I was playing my role as the bad guy, and killing is what a real villain does.
"They can't cope with you," Mum explained. "You're going to a new school. We'll visit soon."
All I recall is being given a card, signed by students and staff. Suddenly I was away with Grandpa, Grandma and my teddy bear, William. I never set foot in Blue House Primary again.